Welcome to the Clifford Barclay Lecture on Social Entrepreneurship. This is an ongoing series of lectures in honour of Clifford Barclay, who was both a successful entrepreneur and a governor of the LSE, and who was extremely committed to higher education. And his family have given the money to the school to run this annual series. We have with us Professor Henrietta Moore, who, as I understand it, I think she's been an institution at the school for a long time, but only joined the school in 1990, saw the error of her ways and left the University of Cambridge to come to the place with real intellectual excitement, which is the LSE. Henrietta has had a wide range of academic interests as an anthropologist with a regional specialisation in Africa, particularly in Eastern Central Africa. She's also been interested in development and in gender, and indeed one of her early appointments here before becoming professor was as first director of the Gender Institute. And so she mixes anthropology, development, and the role of women in development, but more recently has become interested in social entrepreneurship. I have to say, I wasn't entirely clear what social entrepreneurship was. I think I've got a better idea, and certainly at the end of this lecture, I'm sure we'll have an extremely good idea. It's an attempt, as I understand it, to look at entrepreneurs who are responsible for social regeneration and development, and who help to combat social exclusion. So, Henrietta, who has, as I said, this rather distinguished track record as an anthropologist, is, I don't say moving into new fields, but at least is developing a new area, which I think will be of considerable public policy interest in the UK as we try to find ways of combating social exclusion, which has, of course, long been one of the themes of the LSE. Henrietta tells me this is going to be quite a long lecture, so that's enough by way of introduction. Let me pass you straight over. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening. It's a great honour and a privilege to be asked to give this Clifford Barclay Enterprise Lecture. And it's very nice indeed to be able to welcome the members of the Barclay family who are here in the audience this afternoon. Now, no society exists that has not tried to intellectually master the world by constructing images of relations between people and of relations between humans and nature. Anthropologists would argue that this comes not just from a desire to understand, but from a need to locate ourselves in the world. Thus, people desire less to know the world than to recognize themselves in it, to substitute an ungraspable universe with a closed and potentially knowable world. Now, one of the ways we try to master the world through formulating a view of relations between people based on an understanding of human nature relations is through economics. Economics, like all other fields of intellectual endeavour, cannot be separated from the context in which it operates and must draw much of its passion and energy from social values and assumptions. This point is an obvious one, since we know that particular values underpin certain ways of looking at the world, and particular ways of looking at the world provide specific kinds of economics. The social sciences are confronted with a rather special sort of problem, one that I could characterize as transparency. Whenever a social scientist stands up to talk about, for example, society, you can be sure that a significant proportion of their audience thinks that what they say is banal, and much of the rest think that it is obvious. It says much for our academic training that we persist in the belief that part of our audiences think that what we say is profound. Now, certain things appear transparent when they accord unproblematically with experience and/or when they reinforce or resonate with key values and assumptions. Such transparency is, of course, an illusion, but it does underscore the point that the academic and what we might call, for want of a better term, the popular are never separate domains of inquiry. The academic and the popular, public discourse, politics, business, international and social policy, community development, are not closed spheres of activity and interest. They intersect in myriad ways, each forming the imagination of the other. One of the most obvious instances concerns language, phrases, terms, assertions, and apocrypha. What begin as academic concepts enter popular discourse and find new meanings and resonances, such as, for example, Freud's notion of the unconscious. While what arise as matters of general public discussion find their way into academic debates and become codified, specified, and quite changed in shape from their humble beginnings, such as ideas about the nature of persons or the characteristics of society. The traffic down this two-way street has a long history, and many terms, ideas, and concepts cross back and forth between the two domains several times, creating a curious genealogical narrative that can no longer be traced to its origin point, providing for us, if you like, a whole new definition of that now very popular phrase, the third way. Now, one peculiar feature of such boundary crossing is that it reinforces the illusion of transparency. There are certain terms, phrases, and concepts that may be said to be generally understood, to be so obvious in their meaning that they require no further discussion. Recent candidates include the knowledge economy, joined-up thinking, globalization, and the third way. Such phrases are subject to the dictates of fashion, but often not before they have had a profound effect on such diverse domains as public policy, corporate management, governance, and risk assessment. The jury is still out, in my view, as to whether this is a peculiar feature of modern societies, or whether it's just one more example of striving to know the world in order to recognize ourselves within it. The notion of the social entrepreneur occupies a similar space on the boundary of several domains, and has recently caught the attention of local and national politicians, business people, academics, journalists, and community workers in the UK. As a term, it too suffers from the problem of transparency. It is obvious, is it not, what a social entrepreneur is? Or is it? Transparency is, as I've said, frequently illusory. So let's start then with the question, who or what is a social entrepreneur? Several books have now been written about social entrepreneurs, and they do evince a remarkable degree of consensus. Social entrepreneurs are those who deploy entrepreneurial skills for social ends. They create value by building portfolios of resources to address unmet social needs. They seek and find innovative ways of tackling the gaps left by the market and/or the welfare state, and commit themselves to addressing intractable social problems. We are living in a situation where democratic capitalism is finding it difficult to respond to the challenges and the consequences of globalization. In the UK, as elsewhere, the transformation of the economy, the retreat of the welfare state, the impact of information and communication technologies, and long-term unemployment have produced a crisis. This crisis is not just one of poverty, but of social exclusion. Now, the aim of the social entrepreneur is to utilize whatever resources are to hand, to improve the situation of those who are socially excluded, and to promote social cohesion. Social entrepreneurs, unlike their compatriots in the commercial sector, are not motivated by profit, but by enhanced well-being for the communities they work in. They seek to work with and for communities to produce solutions that are innovative, democratic, and sustainable, socially, financially, and environmentally. Social entrepreneurs and the social enterprises they create are one kind of response to a renewed search for the public good. Modern society is driven by both a consumerist and a moral individualism, where criteria for personal achievement and aspiration are closely linked to choice. Under such circumstances, any call for a return to community is likely to be unsuccessful if it simply tries to impose social order and social cohesion. In addition, the societies we live in are increasingly diverse, and maintaining shared values is not a simple or a straightforward task. We may feel that we have a strong sense of the public good and that we know what kind of community we want to live in and be part of, but do others share our views and our values? The challenge, as many writers have pointed out, is how to create a modern sense of the social and of society. Across the whole of Europe, there is a growing sense that modern communities must be decentralized and self-governing. Some would say anti-statist and anti-hierarchical. This does not mean that everyone shares such views, but just that they are now a recognizable and powerful cultural strand in modern European thought. There is an emerging consensus that local action is where innovation will come, and that the local is the space where we will find community strengths based on diversity of interests, skills, resources, and aspirations, a kind of cooperation in diversity. To deliver a renewed sense of the public good, we will need, as a minimum, new mechanisms and new spaces for doing so. One such mechanism is social entrepreneurship, and one such space is the social enterprise. Not all social enterprises are community-based, and not all social entrepreneurs operate at the local level. But it is the impetus for local regeneration and renewal that has provided one of the major drivers of the social entrepreneurship movement. It is impossible to say how many social entrepreneurs there are in the UK. There are certainly thousands worldwide. Guesstimates suggest that as many as 1 million new organisations have been established worldwide since 1970 to focus on issues such as healthcare, human rights, education, disability, the environment, women's rights, and poverty. 20 years ago, the Ashoka Foundation, an organisation that now supports more than 1,000 social entrepreneurs in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and Central Europe, introduced the term social entrepreneur because, according to its founder, Bill Drayton, the most critical ingredient at the heart of social change is the human one. Now, Michael Young is probably the UK's most famous social entrepreneur. He started more than 30 socially oriented organisations, the best known of which is probably the Open University. And in 1997, he began with colleagues the School for Social Entrepreneurship in East London. Andrew Mawson developed with colleagues and the local community a regeneration initiative in Bromley by Bow in the East End of London that brings together health, housing, community care, education, and the arts in one social enterprise. He has since gone on with colleagues to start the Community Action Network, which seeks to identify successful social entrepreneurs, link them both physically and virtually, disseminate best practice, and provide key information on funding, legal issues, and the like. Now, these two national initiatives are part of a drive to promote, develop, and professionalise social entrepreneurship that is evident in the large number of organisations in Europe and the USA that have sprung up in the last few years with the sole purpose of doing just that. The School for Social Entrepreneurship and Community Action Network are designed to underpin the plethora of local activity in the UK, such as, for example, the Acorn Centre. Basically, the Acorn Centre is a multi-purpose community resource centre with managed workspaces, a library, a college, and a cafe, operating in a former coal mining town near Barnsley. It provides basic training in IT skills, it provides vocational skills, and business support and advice. And it runs a number of community enterprises, among them a call centre, a landscaping business, and an electronic village hall. Another example of such a social enterprise is the Portsmouth Community Safety Partnership. This is a set of 5 integrated community services in Portsmouth, which work with young people and their families to reduce crime, substance misuse, and social exclusion and disadvantage. The PCSP is not a small organisation. Has 5 service managers and over 100 full-time staff. And in 1998, 2,000 young people and their families used the services of PCSP. Now, these enterprises need passion, commitment, and dedication to initiate and launch them, and skills to bring diverse resources together for a variety of purposes. They need, in other words, social entrepreneurs. However, their underlying success and sustainability requires more than a single charismatic individual. It requires team building, devolved community participation, and partnership. Leadership is important for social entrepreneurship, as it is for its commercial counterpart, but harnessing, managing, and building the energies and capacities of others is what ultimately makes any kind of enterprise a success. The future, then, of social entrepreneurship is much less likely to be about individuals alone and much more likely to be about the viability of social enterprise. So what is social enterprise, and is it anything new? Many commentators have remarked that certain key factors have created a particular space in which social enterprise can flourish. Chief amongst these is the so-called collapse or retreat of the welfare state. There are two key points in favour of this argument. The first is that some of the most impressive examples of social entrepreneurship and social enterprise come from countries where the welfare state has never existed in the sense in which we use the term in Western Europe. The second is that the welfare state is a relatively recent phenomenon. In the UK, in the latter part of the 19th century and early part of the 20th, social support was provided through a mixture of charity, philanthropy, paternalism, and cooperation. Employers provided housing, education, and healthcare. Poverty and prostitution were tackled by organizations in which women often played a predominant role. Reformers found new ways of financing housing and other social schemes. And the labor movement promoted and supported friendly societies, cooperatives, and mutual assurance schemes. However, even if the roots of contemporary social entrepreneurship lie in an earlier period, there are specific circumstances in the present that are very different. There are, of course, the particular effects of globalization, changing labor market structures, long-term unemployment, the rising costs of welfare, and the consequent crisis in civil society. But these structural features have to be seen in their philosophical context. In trying to come to terms with the very rapid changes we have experienced and to seek some way of managing them, new theories have begun to evolve, and these new theories support new practices. What are these new theories about? They are about human interrelationships and human nature relations. In other words, they are about economics. There is an increasing debate about a new kind of economics, an economics that is ethically, socially, and environmentally responsible. These debates certainly echo earlier radical small is beautiful thinking, but they also go well beyond those postulates in an attempt to rethink the notion of a modern economy. The fundamental question at the root of these debates is what is a modern economy and how will it function? Without this kind of philosophical questioning, it will not be possible to respond to the challenges of globalization and technological change. When we ask the question, what is a modern economy and how would it function, we are inevitably asking what kind of society would we like to live in? If we are not to be overwhelmed by change and the scale of the world around us, then we have to find ways of recognizing ourselves in that world. Within this debate about a new economics, an earlier model of the economy based on a tripartite division between the public, the private, and the voluntary sector has given way to one based on distinctions between the public, private, and social sectors. There is, however, no agreed way of describing this social or third sector, and different analysts have proposed different divisions of the economic cake and have supplied a raft of terms that manage to overlap, reinforce, and undermine each other simultaneously. International debate on these terms has had a very real impact on public policy, and discussions of these issues in the UK has had and will have further significant effects on public policy and on ideas about governance, the role of the state, and the management of the economy. In Spain and Hispanophone countries, the talk is of the popular economy and the solidary economy. In France, Canada, the Netherlands, and Francophone countries, discussion focuses on the social economy, the third sector, and to a lesser extent, the solidary economy. In the UK, until recently, we appeared to claim that we had never heard of a social economy, but that we did do community development. Eventually, this claim provoked a great deal of sarcasm amongst French colleagues who pointed out that it was an Englishman, Samuel Smiles, who had first used the term social economy in his work Thrift, published in 1875. Now, Smiles had then used the term to cover cooperatives, self-help organizations, saving societies, philanthropic and charitable societies, and indeed even the big enterprises like Salt's Mills in Saltaire that had social projects and support systems for their workers. Smiles' definition is an interesting one because it identifies the fact that the social economy intersects with the private sector and cannot be merely reduced to the voluntary sector or cooperatives, mutuals, associations, and friendly societies. The social economy or third sector certainly includes the voluntary sector, but it is much larger than the latter and has a more heterogeneous composition. A certain confusion arises, as with so many of these terms, because definitions are not just about typologies, but about reorientations of values and priorities. One area in which this is evident is in the redefinition of the voluntary sector. In the 1970s in the UK, the third sector, insofar as anyone talked about it, was the voluntary sector. The voluntary sector at that time was not seen as a discrete entity per se, but it was seen as a vehicle for social welfare. In the 1980s, the voluntary sector became increasingly perceived as a possible solution to the welfare state crisis, but it was still not thought of in any serious way as an independent sector. The contemporary social economy, or third sector, cannot simply be reduced to the voluntary sector because its own emergence heralds a shift in thinking about the economy and about the relationship of the state to the market, as well as the relationship between the economic and the social in a modern economy. The social economy exists in a complex relation to the private for-profit sector and the public or state sector through partnerships, stakeholding, joint venturing, trading, and contracting relationships. It is also predicated, in terms of its visibility and potential role, on a particular set of views about communities, civil society, and social values. These views are not new, but they have been rethought and repositioned to a certain extent. The EU has recently decided that the social economy or third sector should be called the third system. A positive gloss on the gratuitous introduction of yet another term into this debate is that it provides for visibility and consequent funding and policy. The desire for visibility comes primarily from two sources: the cost of providing social support and developing the public good, and the potential for job creation within the social economy. The third system is estimated across the European Union to account for between 6 and 6.5% of private enterprises and between 4.5 and 5.3% of employment. In individual countries, the figures are much higher. In France, the third sector accounts for 29% of all employment, in Germany 23%, and in Italy 25%. Now, it's wise to be aware that figures on this sector are notoriously difficult to assess because they vary so widely with definition, and because there are no reliable sampling frames for gathering statistical data. For example, some definitions of the social economy include higher education and businesses with a social orientation, thus pushing figures sky high. And in the USA, healthcare is included in the not-for-profit sector. However, a recent estimate for the UK suggests that the third sector now employs between 2 and 6% of the UK paid labour force, and accounts for between 3 and 9% of GDP. These figures are a great deal lower than some given for continental Europe and reflect problems of definition and categorization. But they still mean that this sector is an important part of the social and economic life of the United Kingdom. One of the eye-catching features of the third sector or third system is its potential for growth. A study of 12 EU countries in 1990 found that there were 1.3 million cooperatives, mutuals, and voluntary organizations involved in some kind of trading or for-profit activity. They employed 5.3 million people and had a combined turnover of more than £1 trillion. Current estimates for the whole of the EU suggest that the sector now employs about 6.4 million people, which is about 4.4% of the total number employed. A 1994 study suggested that the third system in Europe was growing faster than the economy as a whole in terms of jobs, 11% against 3% in Germany, 15.8% against 4.2% in France, and 39% against 7.4% in Italy. Additional European Commission research has suggested that as many as 3 million new jobs could be created in the social economy to service the unmet needs of communities. Now, in December 1997, the Council of the EU adopted a series of employment guidelines, and these guidelines were subsequently adopted by all member states. And they explicitly recognized for the first time the potential for job creation in the social economy. Subsequent national action plans provided measures to promote both the social economy and local development initiatives through the development of social enterprise, as evidenced by this EU statement, which I'm not going to bother to read to you because it's a rather obvious sort of EU statement. Now, the EU Commission's Local Development and Employment Initiative has identified 19 separate areas in which intervention could open up new jobs for the unemployed, and these include home help and childcare services, security, housing and neighbourhood improvements, local shops, culture and leisure activities, new information technologies, and a whole range of environmental businesses, including waste disposal and recycling. It is evident that the emphasis here is on local jobs that maintain and support the social and economic fabric of communities. Social cohesion and social renewal are the key drivers. What is also clear is that the third sector or third system suddenly became mainstream in terms of public policy in the late 1990s. First steps in the UK included the launch of regional compacts between the government and the third sector, although arguably when these pacts were launched in 1998, this was primarily seen as a compact between the government and the voluntary sector. It involved a fiscal review of charities and a commitment announced in 1999 to invest in a government unit called the Active Community Unit, charged with dealing with third sector issues. What all this activity adds up to is three things. A new way of conceiving of a modern economy. It now has a sector called the social economy. A new relationship between the social economy and the state, underpinned by public policy. And a new relationship between the social economy and the market. Now, how can we characterize this new set of relationships in practical terms? The detail of the pattern, of course, varies from country to country, but the outlines show a remarkable consistency. If we turn to look at continental Europe, Italy, for example, has seen an explosion of social enterprises since the 1980s, with a new statute in 1991 giving them specific legal status. These enterprises operate predominantly in two areas: the provision of social, educational, and health services, and the reinsertion into work of disadvantaged groups. The situation in Spain is somewhat similar, with huge growth since the 1980s. And in Belgium, more than 4,000 not-for-profit organizations were created each year in the 1990s, although a significant number are what might be termed para-profit or para-public organizations. These organizations typically focus their activities around the goals of social cohesion and community empowerment. Their core values are connected to securing citizen participation, establishing proper representation of excluded minorities, and promoting user control. They draw on values associated with the cooperative movement, community activism and development, feminism, and environmental campaigning. They promote the development of social capital, that is, networks of trust, resources, and capacities within communities. Their performance criteria are based on social outcomes, but at the same time, they aim to retain surpluses within the community and to provide new services and products through the creation of new local jobs. The result is a creative set of relationships that draw on public, private, voluntary, and not-for-profit activities. Many of these organizations are run by individuals who label themselves as social entrepreneurs, who see their value added coming in the form of enhanced social solidarity and reduced social exclusion, and many of whom are explicitly calling for a new form of capitalism based on a revised form of social contract. In other words, they are developing and promoting the idea that the economy has to be reconceived in the context of a new form of social citizenship, that is, in the context of a revised way of thinking about the relationship between individuals and the state. Much of the best work specifying how this rethinking should work has been done by scholars working in France and Quebec. The situation in Quebec is particularly interesting because it provides a possible model for the future of the UK. The starting point for discussion in the Canadian context is that we are no longer dealing with dual or tripartite models of the economy, but with something called the plural economy. This plural economy is one where the boundaries between traditional sectors have blurred, and where recognition has to be given to the intersections and interdependencies of all the different sectors of the economy, including the domestic non-monetary economy and the social economy, as well as the market and state sectors. Now, what has this meant in concrete terms in Quebec? What kind of organization do you get? Well, Le Chic Resto Pop is a local restaurant meal service started in 1985 with, I may say, money donated from the trade unions. It uses foodstuffs that have attained sell-by date. It provides 500 meals for children in 6 schools, and it sells the rest of the meals to unemployed people, people on benefits, and low-paid workers. It employs 14 permanent and about 90 contract staff who are anyway on a government back-to-work program. Has an annual budget of around $800,000 Canadian dollars, $300,000 from the sale of services, $100,000 from gifts and charities, and about $400,000 from state sources, that is for carrying out state-based programs. Le Chic Resto Pop also manages to run a community assistance centre, a training centre with access support, a counselling support centre, and a cultural centre for youth. This is only one of very many such social enterprises, but its profile is typical. What is immediately evident is that its overall budget is small, but that it has diversified revenue streams, drawing on regional and national budgets, sales, and charitable donations. Its scale of impact is local, and it supports local social objectives, as evidenced by the diversity of its portfolio of activities. Commentators in Quebec feel that these social enterprises are innovative because they do 3 things. They focus on assistance to the community that is socio-economic rather than simply social. They address new kinds of social problems in new kinds of ways. And they assert that answers to local problems reside in local development led by local people. On this last point, many commentators have begun to declare that this is producing a new form of citizenship, a new relationship between civil society and the state. What is at issue here, amongst other things, is a move away from dependency towards empowerment, accompanied by a determined call for autonomy. One corollary of this is that these new forms of community action are an alternative, in some sense, to social movements, unions, feminist organizations, ecological movements. Perhaps not alternatives exactly, but new spaces. Social enterprises where the values of those social movements and other social values are pursued through local social action. It is for this reason that social enterprises are not just social versions of commercial firms. And in my view, social entrepreneurs are not just social versions of commercial entrepreneurs. Social enterprises are new kinds of enterprise altogether. Now, one of the commonest criticisms of social enterprises of this kind is that they are just drops in the ocean. How can they possibly make any impact on problems like unemployment, which, if anything, are global rather than local problems? Well, in the UK, much has been made over the last 20 years of the importance of small firms for stimulating employment and growth. Le Chico might only have a turnover of about £500,000 a year, but there are many small enterprises in the UK with turnovers of much less than that. Social enterprises, then, are often small, and like other small businesses, their benefits will be cumulative and locally based. A survey of 404 social enterprises in Bristol found that 56% of them had annual revenues of under £250,000. Many modern social enterprises are amalgams of a community enterprise and a small commercial firm that receives public funding for providing contracted out welfare state services. There are thus interesting questions as to whether the size of such social enterprises are necessarily limited by the nature of their activities and their revenues, as well as by their low asset and capital base. In Bristol, approximately half of the organisations surveyed indicated that further growth was constrained by difficulties in securing finance, and approximately 30% identified the problem as a lack of capital finance. There are certainly examples of larger social enterprises that approximate small to medium-sized firms in both the UK and the USA. One rather famous example is the case of Bill Strickland, who runs Manchester Craftsmen's Guild and its associated social enterprises in Pittsburgh. This is a social non-profit organisation which rescues at-risk school children, runs various innovative training partnerships with business, runs a food business and a jazz concert hall, and has created a Grammy Award-winning record label, which I'm sure is the thing making the most money out of all of these activities. Bill Strickland employs about 110 people and has an annual turnover in excess of $10 million and manages to secure about $3.5 million a year of state funding. Now, an annual turnover of approximately £6 million is not a particularly big business. And it is true that in Europe and the USA, even the bigger social enterprises are far smaller than many of the larger charities and trust funds. However, the larger social enterprises tend to be those who utilize borrowing as part of their portfolio and have assets as well as robust future cash flows. What research shows is that donations of assets and funds for capital projects are usually essential for growth beyond a certain point. In addition, the successful social entrepreneurs are those who are best networked in terms of the state, local business, and charities. In Pittsburgh, Bill Strickland managed to get his vocational training program ensconced as a line item in the state budget. Networking across sectors is crucial to the success of social enterprises in the UK. The emphasis on regeneration and social exclusion in the UK government's current policies, plus the partnership-based approach to new deals, sure starts, and new opportunities, as well as to education and health action zones and the new learning and enterprise councils, means that a new space has opened up, one that is also heavily supported by EU funds, in which social entrepreneurs can network and stitch a portfolio of opportunities together. The resulting social enterprises are curious animals, because they both provide welfare services to the community through government contracts and deliver on government strategic objectives, such as welfare to work, training, employment, and so on. However, while social entrepreneurs and social enterprises know that they are delivering social services, there is little overt mention of the fact that in so doing, they are delivering on government policy objectives. This means that while social entrepreneurs and social enterprises focus their motives and values on autonomy, on local service delivery, and on enhancement of opportunity and social solidarity at the local level, they are in fact crucially dependent for their existence on the state. Consequently, the growth of individual social enterprises and the potential scalability of the social economy in general will be dependent upon continuing to carve out a space on the boundaries of the state, the market, and philanthropy. Now, one question remains an open one, and that is, how will the social economy work at a metropolitan or regional level? There may be new spaces for social enterprise, but what are the coordinating structures or objectives? This is where an emphasis on the social economy, rather than simply on social entrepreneurs and social enterprises, is essential, and is especially so if we agree that the effects of social enterprise must needs be cumulative. In spite of all the rhetoric about the social economy, there is no coherent national nor indeed EU framework for its development. There are also no established data sets which can be used to assess the regional impact of the social or third sector, and some would argue that it's really too early for any impact to be evident anyway. However, a small number of local authorities in the UK have begun to conduct social audits and to begin to plan and to outline strategic objectives for the enhancement of the social economy in their area. Bristol City Council is one local authority that actively promotes the social economy as a means of meeting community needs and advancing regeneration. And in 1999, 1,058 social enterprises were identified in the city. The third sector in Bristol, of course, consists, as you would imagine, of co-ops and community businesses, development trusts, and community development agencies. It's backed up by a network of credit unions and by the fact that Bristol is home to a number of national and international third sector economy organisations. What do these social enterprises do in the third sector? Well, they do all the things you would expect them to do. They do childcare and social meals. They do residential care for the elderly. They do primary care and drugs advice, which might surprise you more. They do training, business advice and support, and provide sports facilities in the city, as well as run a number of environmental enterprises. Now, social enterprises in Bristol are actively supported by the local authority, and are linked to the strategic aims and objectives of local government. The underlying drivers are to meet social needs and promote social cohesion. But there is little reliable information on the overall contribution of the third sector to the wealth or social cohesion of the city in terms of jobs, financial value, or social capital. 404 social enterprises in the city were surveyed with a combined annual turnover of £78 million. They employed a little over 4,500 people, of whom about half of those were full-time employment, and they provided another 8,000 volunteer positions. Social audits from other UK cities also suggest that the economic contribution of the social economy can be significant. An audit of the third sector in Leicester in 1995 revealed that its overall value was £209 million and that it provided about 4,000 jobs, equivalent to 8.6% of all the service jobs in the city. Now, Bristol has set itself very impressive targets for the development of the third sector, and they're on the screen for you. What these targets reveal is a commitment to finding local economic solutions to local problems, but it is all too apparent that this commitment comes in advance, as it has to in practice, to be fair, of any aggregate evidence to support the proposition that the social economy is scalable, can provide sustainable economic and social solutions, meet the unmet needs of the community, and address social exclusion. This commitment also comes in advance, as the work in Bristol showed, of any popular or local understanding of the social economy as a coherent entity and/or as a mechanism for enhancing social solidarity. This does not mean that local people are not participating in and/or not committed to social enterprises, but it does mean that they do not necessarily see their activities as part of a new sector called the social economy. Thus, the revision of state market civil relations on which the social economy is said to rest, according to the work in Quebec, for example, may not be taking place at the cultural level, even if it is, to a certain extent, at the practical level. Now, what might be the consequences of this for the future of the social economy and social entrepreneurship? The most fervent advocates of the latter argue that they need to be given further space and resources to grow and develop. If the predictions of European research are borne out, and there are really large numbers of jobs to be created within the social economy that will meet community needs on the ground, and if the social sector itself really will grow faster than the rest of the economy, then there is a clear case for investment and support. Arguments about growth potential and future growth rates are extremely difficult to assess. But one key point of interest here is the increasing competition, evident in the USA for some time and becoming increasingly evident in Europe, between the so-called not-for-profit social enterprise organizations working in the social economy and commercial organizations who are interested in making inroads into certain areas. There was quite a scandal in the USA when a division of the defense giant Lockheed Martin teamed up with Anderson Consulting to form a bid for $563 million contract for welfare operations in Texas. Now, this bid broke down, but since then, Lockheed Martin has won more than 20 contracts and provides four states with mental health care, drug and alcohol treatment, childcare, skills training, and job placement. Outsourcing has grown fast and is still expanding the scope of the social service marketplace. Maximus, a provider of welfare to work services in the USA, informed investors in its prospectus that the administration of social programs is a $21 billion market. Now, the idea that substantial equity investment can be raised on the back of the social services market is somehow more shocking to European sensibilities than the fact that it is possible to make money from outsourcing. The situation in the UK is very different from that in the States. But what might be some of the pitfalls as well as the benefits of scaling up the social economy in the UK? One of the attractions of the social economy is that it is not the market and not the state. In a sense, it makes up for the failures of both. But what will the relationship between the state and the social economy in the UK look like in 30 years' time? It's a fairly certain bet that there will be more publicly paid for, but not publicly run, social and welfare services. In other words, outsourcing will continue and develop further. These services will be run by a wide variety of enterprises and agencies with increasingly diversified portfolios, including trading, mutuality, borrowing, asset sales, donations, grants, and volunteers. However, their major revenues will most probably come from the state. But what sort of a state are we talking about? Now, under this model, the state will continue, as we heard from Gordon Brown yesterday at the LSE, to become less of a provider and more of an enabler. The key issue for the enabling state is, of course, regulation. Quality of service, production of specified outcomes, value for money. Such things require auditing, benchmarking, and the development of additional mechanisms to achieve such processes, such as new outcome measures. These facets of regulation are already much in evidence. All the various European and national government-funded programs have success criteria and outcome measures linked to impact assessment. One of the key questions that arises here concerns the relationship between the state and civil society. If the social economy grows rapidly, then the quality of social services will very much depend on the abilities and capacities of local social entrepreneurs and social enterprises. The state may no longer be interested in equality, but even to maintain equity, government will need to intervene through regulatory frameworks and practices. The social economy will thus remain dependent on the state, both economically and socially. Now, changing ideas about the appropriate role of the state are at the basis of much of this kind of thinking. There is one argument that says that the creation of the welfare state signalled the death knell of a particular kind of mutual and associative life in the UK. In other words, amongst other things, a cultural perception grew up whereby people expected the state to provide certain things, notably education, health, and support in old age. Now, care for the elderly was the first area to be outsourced to private providers. There has been much disquiet about the quality of provision, and lobbying continues around the area of personal contributions. But on the whole, the situation has been quietly accepted. But even if the public have accepted this situation for the elderly, would they be willing to accept it for education and healthcare? Current debates around education and the National Health Service in the UK suggest not. Popular opinion would seem to strongly support government provision of education and health services. Although quasi-markets have existed in healthcare for some time, although most members of the public seem only to have a limited understanding of these markets, how they work, and of their possible impact on healthcare provision. More pertinently, perhaps, new developments within health and education action zones are opening up the possibility of more direct outsourcing of services to private companies. For example, a number of schools may soon be publicly funded but run by private companies, and in the future, whole education authorities might succumb. These developments suggest that while public opinion favours state provision of education and healthcare, the practicalities surrounding that provision may be changing faster than people realise. Equally, public disquiet about the quality of provision in both areas suggests that opening up these sectors more directly to social entrepreneurs and drawing them into the social economy might in the end prove more beneficial than simply opening them up to the market per se. Why? The answer is that social enterprises, whether they have a portfolio of for-profit activities or not, are committed to performance measures based on enhanced well-being and the public good, as well as to the return of surplus to the community in some form or other. There could be, therefore, considerable benefits to promoting and developing a notion of the social economy at the national and the local level. This is particularly the case when we recognise that social entrepreneurs and social enterprises are willing to continue to operate in situations and contexts where markets do not function adequately. Private companies will only provide social and welfare services as long as there is money in it. The moment there is not, they will move on. Social enterprises are able to withstand a degree of insolvency on the part of their clients because they are committed to certain locales, because they move resources between activities within very diverse portfolios based on local community need, and because they have access to grants and donations. The argument then for promoting the social economy and social entrepreneurship is that the state would provide some resources, but that local communities would work to develop and improve their own provision and do so in innovative ways that meet their specific needs. Social enterprises would be measured against social and economic outcomes relating to enhancement of the public good, and surpluses would be returned to communities rather than going in directors' bonuses or dividends. Now, what are the risks involved in taking this road? The most obvious relate to governance and accountability. Proponents of social entrepreneurship point to the openness and democratic nature of social enterprises and their mechanisms for devolving power to the communities they benefit. In the case of trusts, cooperatives and mutuals, there are regulations governing or covering governance and accountability. For other social enterprises, there are none. This is partly because social enterprises are very diverse entities. Potential issues of governance exist under present arrangements. The UK government has, for example, strongly committed itself to the notion of partnership. All the new deals and opportunities and action zones have partnership criteria. However, these partnerships end up being run by bodies and committees that are not elected. And while local government is involved in such partnerships, it does not necessarily play a determining role. In many instances, the idea is that these bodies are accountable both to local people and to central government. But the government cannot adequately monitor the huge number of local initiatives currently underway, not even through regulatory mechanisms related to outcome measures. Local people may be consulted about programmes, may be involved in their design and management, and may sit as representatives on boards and committees. But the degree to which and the means by which any of these large partnerships are directly accountable to the communities they serve is a moot point. The issues of governance and accountability are closely linked to questions of risk. If the social economy is to develop and be promoted in the UK, it will transform relations between the market and the state, and between the state and civil society, in line with the degree to which it incorporates and sustains new forms of risk management. Providing childcare, education and healthcare, as well as other support and community services within a local economy is about redistributing risk for local people and providing them with new means for managing it. New forms of mutuality, mutual aid schemes and community-based financial provision are about innovative mechanisms for managing social risk and providing individuals and families with social insurance. If social and economic regeneration fails to deliver, and if social and welfare services are increasingly provided by private enterprises with no commitment to the community or to its sustainability, then the communities involved will simply be further exposed to the risks they are already confronting and losing the battle with. The success of the social economy will depend on how well it delivers for individuals, families and communities on social and economic outcomes. Outcomes, particularly if they are to be judged in terms of impact, such as their impact on reducing risk exposure, need to be measured, and measurement depends on indicators. A number of researchers and commentators have worked and are working on developing new economic and social indicators of well-being, social inclusion, sustainability and the public good. In fact, much of that work is going on here at the LSE. These new indicators are based on ideas about wider models of wealth creation and new forms of capital, including social capital. Capital in the social economy is no longer just about money, assets and equity in the conventional economic sense, but is also about the forms of currency that exist in social exchanges, such as time given in work to support the community, the social and economic assets developed in terms of social networks and resources, economic resources and environmental sustainability, the social capital invested in trust, cooperation and participation in civic life, the human capital developed in individuals and families through improved education and healthcare, and the equity held by all members of the community in their social and economic environments and the returns made now and in the future on that equity. The UK government has taken the first step by publishing headline sustainable development indicators for major environmental and social issues and plans to publish an annual report on targets and attainments. For the first time in 2000, the British Household Panel Survey, the General Household Survey and the Health Survey for England will contain questions relating to social capital and civic participation. When these figures are available, they will allow us to measure the social and economic impact of certain kinds of policies and to examine the degree to which social exclusion is being tackled. This will be the first step towards the measurement of the social economy. Although it is true that much more work will need to be done to further develop innovative social and economic models of wealth creation, sustainability, and risk management for communities. So finally, the conclusion of this paper is that we might have social entrepreneurs and social enterprises, but we do not yet really have a social economy, in spite of all the rhetoric about third sectors and third economies. A social economy is a way of modelling the world, while social entrepreneurs and social enterprises are methods for achieving that remodelling in practice. If we truly want a social economy, we will have to create one. In order to do so, we will have to conceive of new ways of imagining the relationships between people and between people and nature. We will have to recognize ourselves differently within the world. A social economy involves rethinking the relationship between the state and the individual, between individual risk and collective risk, between individual choice and socially based altruism. It will involve refashioning not only our view of economics, but also our view of the relationship between the economic and the social. Social entrepreneurs and social enterprises are not self-evident categories or entities, in spite of their recent popularity. Developing a space in which they can operate and specifying the kinds of institutions, intentions, and outcomes that will underpin them will require measurement and assessment of impact, as well as a means for measuring enhancement of the public good. Of all these things, the public good is always the least self-evident and yet the most transparent. However, if we are to develop new ideas about the economy, reformulate the relationship between the economic and the social, rethink the relationship between the state and the individual, develop new ideas about wealth creation and sustainability, and then measure the benefits of all these things, as well as provide for the development of new institutions and mechanisms to oversee them, then we will need a committed social science. Social scientists, you see, do not believe that anything is transparent or self-evident, and they know that particular ways of recognizing ourselves in the world underpin our intellects as well as our imaginations. Thank you.
I think we have time for a few questions. Would anybody like to lead off with a question to Henrietta?
Oh, good, I can go home.
Well, No, you can't. I have a question. I was very struck by the small scale of the enterprises you're talking about. One had 100 part-time employees, it had a manager and some executives. It reminds me very much of the sort of debate 15, 20 years ago about cooperative organisations generally, and in which one of the crucial features preventing their scalability was their difficulty of coming up with efficient and effective management systems, given their attempt often to embody other sorts of values in the way they organize themselves, like democracy, social responsibility, isn't always the easiest way to organize an organization which has to deliver a service. What are your views on that? Is it possible?
Well, I certainly think it's possible. I mean, there are two parts of your question, really. The first is that, yes, social enterprises have exactly the same kinds of problems as identified for the earlier debate around cooperatives, and that is that finding management structures that do deliver on the kinds of social outcomes and goals that you want is actually very, very difficult. Yep. It's not easy to do at all. But where things may be changing paradoxically is that there is beginning to be a general sea change in management structures in general in business, right? And in the nature of corporate governance. And paradoxically, some of the impetus all those new management structures may come from a source where the social enterprises least expect them to come from, is what I think.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Anyone else have a question? Yes, back there.
I'm a local authority councillor in Islington, and I also...
Oh, good.
Sit down.
I'm wired still.
I'm a local authority councillor in the London Borough of Islington, and I'm also... a lecturer at Cranfield School of Management in entrepreneurship. So I'm here with sort of two hats on, really.
Right.
I have two sort of main comments. My first is your comment that social enterprises can withstand a degree of insolvency. Mm-hmm. And in my experience as a trustee of one reasonably sized education charity, which is a 25 million turnover charity, and one much smaller local development trust based in Finsbury Park.
Right.
That is simply not my experience of either of those two businesses, social businesses. Balancing the books on the £25 million charity is you know, a sort of work of great creative genius,
yes,
by our financial director,
yes,
each year.
Yes.
And my last meeting at the Finsbury Park area was one where we were looking very much at the sort of was it a going concern. There are still legal boundaries and legislation covers these businesses, and often the reliance on European Union funding means that they are waiting you know, sometimes 6-12 months in arrears for funding to come through for outcomes and objectives that they've already achieved. So I think there's a real issue about the fact that they can be, you know, they can get a proportion of their funding from the public sector, because actually that makes them incredibly dependent and very inflexible in certain ways. My second question to you is, when you were describing the social economy, you were looking at things like much more sort of personal care services. And one of the big issues, I mean, Islington has actually outsourced, you know, been compelled,
yeah,
to outsource,
yeah,
its education service. So it's a sort of interesting times there. But the big issue that's going on in all public authorities and local authorities at the moment is the transfer of housing stock.
Yeah.
And the kind of what, you know, in terms of capital transfer, we've just transferred, I think, 500 social houses to the Peabody Trust and New London Housing Association. And that means that they're able to invest £50 million in those estates over the next however many years.
Mm.
But it's kind of, social enterprises are also things like the Peabody Trust that have been going,
yeah,
for 150 years. Mm. And I'm surprised not to hear you say anything about housing, which is, I think, where the massive growth in this sector is going to be. So maybe you could comment on that, please.
Okay, well, if I may come back to the first point, I don't think that any of these social enterprises can afford themselves to be insolvent. It was that their clients are, was the point I was trying to make. I mean, there are difficulties about setting up. I mean, what's so puzzling to me in a way about a lot of this discussion is that these are issues which I was working with in Africa in the 1970s, and they're now suddenly on the agenda in a new way in the new millennium in the UK. And so somehow, and none of the lessons of that period seem to have been learned, but one of the great problems of any kind of social enterprise sustaining itself through some kind of trading activity is, can the people who are around you afford to buy whatever it is you are selling them? And very often they can't, or they can't do it without subsidy. Now, what happens with social in those moments, I think, much less likely to move immediately than other kinds of commercial-based enterprises, because a sensibly run commercial-based enterprise would not sustain an ongoing loss for any particular length of time. And social enterprises which committed to certain locales can't really, you know, can't up sticks and leave, but they all have the problem that you're describing for the Finsbury situation. What was your second point?
Housing.
Well, I deliberately didn't talk about housing, because housing is a very tricky issue, because housing is the one area of social enterprise where there are serious, serious assets, right? And that means that housing trusts and housing associations are, of all the social enterprises in the UK, the ones that are able, if they wish, to borrow, right, to sell assets, and to realise capital through the sale of assets. And so they become, in contrast with others, a very, very specific kind of sector. And actually, it's good you raised the issue of housing, because I think that there are a lot of people in the LSE working on housing, so I should be very cautious about what I say, because I'm not an expert on housing, and I'll get myself into a lot of trouble. But the thing that really interests me about housing is that in fact, in a sense, some of the housing associations are almost at the same point that other kinds of mutuals have been at. In other words, you know, why are building societies no longer mutuals? And the answer is because they're no longer mutual societies, mutual associations, so they've given up that status. And I think housing is the one area where, because they have so much in assets, they are really quite unlike all the other kinds of social enterprises. Because I can't think, apart from some very big charities, of other social enterprises that have that amount of asset. So we should continue this sort of
one more question, then we'll close. Yes, there.
I would be grateful if you would comment on my observations. My background as an architect, I'm interested in patterning, spatial patterning,
yeah,
now applied to the city and the region. and I have recently been described as an independent thinker. The observation I wish to make is that a great deal of the disconnectedness, the lack of making connections, joined up thinking, the fragmentation, which is pervasive in the whole of this field and has been for very long, may well, and in my opinion, is very likely attributable to the lack of spatial coherence, which goes down to the political boundaries which we artificially impose on still spatial communities which can be mapped and can be encouraged to express themselves around local high streets, town centres, which have been devastated by the drawing of political boundaries which do not define communities but divide them. I'm talking particularly of wards in cities and towns. I'm talking of enumeration districts, which are the units of information which divide and even go down the centres of local streets, which carry within them the prospect of local mutual organisation. And the very system by which we collect the information means that we not only prevent communities from identifying themselves, from finding one another, from coming together, to hearing and finding information which is relative to themselves, but the whole system needs to look very, very seriously at this whole matter before we can begin to get a coherent grasp and to target our efforts.
Well, the whole area, as you know far better than I, of local regeneration activities and the way in which funding goes to certain areas, spatial areas, which represent certain kinds of communities and not to others, and the problems that has caused in certain parts of the UK are well known. And equally, it's a well-known fact that paradoxically that many of the initiatives which were thought to do things like relieve housing problems and poverty ended up creating kind of sinks of poverty and disadvantage and so on, which then become very, very difficult, if not impossible, to escape from. But I don't think I'm really qualified to comment very directly on what you said. But I mean, certainly the problem about how do communities form and what are the boundaries of communities the same boundaries as those administrative boundaries or those politically drawn boundaries or indeed even physical boundaries is a serious issue. And quite a lot of work in the LSE is going on here under the Architecture and Cities Programme on precisely that point. So.
Okay.
Are we done?
Yeah, we're done. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much, Henry. It was a wonderful lecture. And I thank very much to the Barclay family for sponsoring this series.